It's McCowan, it's Shannon once again on the program. John, you're okay this morning, I assume?
Oh, are you kidding me? After last night, what we watched, the Canadian invasion of New York City? Absolutely.
It was a perfect day in New York for Canadians. Blue Jays win, and we'll talk about that. Buck Martinez will join us in a bit. And on the tennis courts, our two young phenoms both advanced to the semifinals of the U.S. Open. Never happened before.
Well, and we've never had a male play in a U.S. Open semifinal. So here we go. And Auger Alassime maybe gets an even bigger break with the fact that he gets a short stint because of injury of his opponent and gets some rest before he plays on Friday.
Yeah, and it's and for those who did not watch the match yesterday, Auger Alassime was in control of that match. I don't really know when the injury specifically occurred, whether it was in his last match or sometime during the one, but he was full marks for the victory.
Alcaraz, it certainly looked like he was taped up right from the beginning, Bob, and was trying to, you know,
fight through,
struggle through. Yeah, struggle through and fight through everything that went on. As far as on the women's side, I have never seen a more guttural third set from both players than you watched last night.
It was a fantastic match.
Both of them deserve a ton of credit, but both of them were playing on fumes by the end.
Oh, gosh, yes. Layla was... she is a really fun player to watch.
Yeah.
Her first serve was horrendous yesterday. Absolutely horrendous. And so she kept sticking these 75 mile per hour second serves in there, which for those that aren't educated it's like a lob, and gutting it out on the ground. Yeah. And she comes up with shots that are quite remarkable.
Her work on the baseline and her work at how she angles her racket and disguises shots is pretty impressive, Bob.
Well, what we've seen a lot in this tournament, I don't know how much people have watched, and I've watched a fair bit here, and I maybe because I got time, but I've really been interested in this U.S. Open, probably far more than any other. Maybe it's because of the Canadians being involved, but Leila Fernandez basically stands on the baseline. And what we've seen in this tournament is more and more players standing 8, 10, 12 feet behind the baseline, not just to return serve, but with ground strokes too. That's sort of where they plant themselves. And she takes the ball so early. It's really quite extraordinary. Now, you know, it doesn't get any easier. She gets the number 2 seed. She beat the number 3, beat the number 5, I think.
Yeah, 5 last night.
Yeah, I think now. So now she's beaten 3 seeded players. And now she'll get number 2. But nothing is beyond the realm of possibility.
No, it's, I tell you, and a few people in talking over the last couple of days, when you talk about sports, you know, usually you talk about, well, what's going to happen in hockey season. The first comment from everybody I've talked to is about the tennis. People have really, really glommed on to what's going on in Flushing. And it's fun to watch.
One of the other things I saw for the first time, and maybe I just missed it previously, but Felix now referred to as FAA during the broadcast, which I think is, I mean, that's, I, you know, look at everybody kind of gets a moniker at some point if they're successful. He's 21 years old and already they got a nickname for him.
Well, and he gets Medvedev on Friday, and they've only played once before, and Medvedev won. But that was a long time ago. And I think he was just 18 years old. And at 21 years old, he's now a grizzled veteran, Bob.
Well, every day has provided another bar to climb over, but they've managed to do it every single time. So we'll anxiously await the semifinals for the two Canadians. We got a couple days to wait for that to happen, though. Blue Jays, meanwhile, still on a roll. We'll talk about it. The voice of the Blue Jays, Buck Martinez, will join us after these messages. If I told you 2 weeks ago, the Toronto Blue Jays would be two games out of a wild card and right in the thick of it, you'd have thought I was crazy. I think their chances of making the wild card were like 5% or 6% or something like that. They're about four or five times that now. Another victory last night, probably an unlikely one, given the opponent's starting pitcher. But they roll again, another victory, 5-1. Buck Martinez joins us. Do you think they were dead, honestly?
Yeah, even some of the players said that when they were down by six runs against the A's on Friday night in the eighth inning. They all kind of said, hey, we're dead in the water right now. But then they got the spark, and Gurriel tied it up. And then after falling behind, Marcus Semien hit the three-run walk-off home run, and that really fueled them. But, you know, this hot streak, and you're right, you know, what, 10 days ago, 12 days ago, we were not thinking about the postseason, but Vladdy got hot. And generally, when your star gets hot, everybody else follows suit. And, you know, he had his hit streak stop last night after 14 in a row, but during that 14-game hit streak, the Blue Jays really came on as a team.
I thought – go ahead, John, please.
The Friday game with the grand slam and then the two-run homer to win it might be the watershed moment for this season, Buck. It might be the one that everybody points to and says, turn the season around. And it's usually not this late in the season. It's usually closer to earlier in August. But that might be the thing that everybody points to. Is that correct?
Yeah, John, I think so. And when you think about it, too, the guy that hit it, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., has been hot, too. And, you know, we've always waited for one of these hot streaks from him because we saw it a couple of years ago in 2019 when they had that 11-game multi-hit game with extra base hits. And he had 11-game streak then, and now he's hot again. And he's driven in, I believe, 14 runs in his last six games going back to that grand slam. So, yeah, there are a lot of things that have contributed to this, but certainly the offense has been the strength of this team all year long. But, boy, in the second half, the starting pitching has been phenomenal.
It's been unbelievable. I've been waiting for this kind of streak. I've had the feeling that this team is capable of this kind of run all year long. They had one little six or seven game streak earlier in the year. I don't remember exactly. But for this to happen in September, and it comes, as you guys suggest, off that comeback against the Oakland A's. Have you been on teams that have been motivated for lengthy success as a result of a single event like that?
Oh, sure. You go back to different years and different teams. And, you know, we had a great team in Kansas City in the 70s. We had great teams in the Blue Jays in the mid-80s. And going back to late 70s with the Brewers, there were a lot of guys on those teams that would get milestone hits to get something going, you know, whether it was George Brett or Robin Yount or Hal McRae or Paul Molitor, John Olerud, Alomar, you know, there's a host of guys that have had that ability on a lot of teams I've played. But yeah, this is an interesting one because the team is so young. And that was the question. Will they hold up in September? Because Bo and Vladdy, they went into slumps early in August, and they looked like they were getting tired and things weren't going to turn around for them. But, boy, they snapped right around. And Bo had a 10-game hit streak right alongside with Vladdy's 14-gamer. So they're proving a lot of people that they are really good players and they can stand up to the rigors of a six-month season.
What has Steven Matz has had, seven really good consecutive starts. What has changed for him and what is he doing that's keeping the ball under control?
Well, you guys have heard me say this time and time again about Pete Walker. I think Pete Walker is as good a pitching coach as there is in the game. And I think what Pete does, it's almost, and Bob, I know you can relate to this. It's almost like a caddy standing behind a pitcher saying, now throw this one. Okay, now this one's going to work. And what he's done to Steven Matz is he's got him staying on top of his two-seamer. So when he does that, he's able to command it better, and it doesn't run along the plane of the bat. It goes down. And in the start last night, he was so good at throwing strikes on the inside corner to right-handed hitters. And that's a key. If you throw it inside and it's off the plate, hitters just raise their arms, let it go, and then go back to the outside part of the plate. But last night, he was forcing the Yankees to honor that inside strike. And that set up his changeup. Gio Urshela had no idea what to do last night. He was so overmatched, and he struck out a couple of different times, and he had no idea what Mats was going to throw him. And I thought Reese McGuire and Steven Mats did a great job of mixing their pitches very well. But it'll go back to Pete Walker, because Pete, what he does as a pitching coach, he looks at what you have as an arsenal and then kind of evaluates what fits after what pitch, and he puts it together perfectly. And I think Steven Matz has been a product of that.
Well, I think the Blue Jays have the best pitching coach in all of baseball, and maybe by a mile. And I think this guy has proven it over and over again, just as you said, Buck. I know I don't sit in on the conversations. Obviously, I've never heard him talk to pitchers. I don't know what his demeanor is. I don't know what his approach is. I mean, you talked about golf and caddies. You know, one of the rules of being a caddy is you don't put any negative thoughts into your player's head.
Exactly.
You know, constant positive reinforcement. You know, if you think it's a set, if the caddy thinks it's a 7-iron, the player is convinced it's a 6-iron, you say, you know what? You're right. It's a 6-iron. Go ahead and hit the 6. Yeah. Right. And I assume that Pete does that same kind of thing with his pitching staff, probably much as you did as a catcher when you went out to the mound. No.
Yes, exactly. You never want to say, hey, don't let this guy hurt you. And say, hey, you're in a good spot right now. We can get this guy out. Just make one good pitch. And that's what Pete does so well. You know, Pete pitched for the Blue Jays and pitched for me, and he's always been kind of an upbeat guy. But since he's become a pitching coach, he has looked at different things. And Alek Manoah is going to be an example of that tonight, because what he has done with Manoah, he's moved him to the middle of the rubber. And again, you'll relate to this because of golf. But golf is all about alignment, and so is pitching. Maddux used to talk about it all the time. When he would put his foot down, he would point his toe to where he wanted the ball to go. And if he wanted it outside, he'd point it to the first base side of the plate. If he wanted it inside, he'd point it to the third base side of the plate. And it's all about alignment. Alek throws across his body. So if you're starting on the third base side of the rubber, you're really creating a difficult angle to get that ball inside the lefties and away from righties. So now if you move over to the center, you've reduced that angle and you've allowed the ball to get onto the inside corner lefties and stay away from the righties. And it's just so easy and it's so simple. It's all about angles. And you know that with golf, it's how you set up. It's not so much the path of your swing, it's your alignment, whether you're putting or hitting drivers or anything. And it's the same with pitching.
Well, and I find that really intriguing because, you know, all three of us play the game of golf. If I'm going to hit a draw, I'm a right-handed golfer, as I think we all are. If I'm going to hit a draw, I'm going to go to the left side of the tee box, which gives me the angle to turn the ball in. If I want to hit a cut, I'm going to go to the right side of the tee box to give me that angle. And I always thought it was to the pitcher's advantage to play with the rubber, the positioning on the rubber. Go to the left side of the rubber with right-handed hitters, the right side with left-handed hitters, or vice versa. But would you be a proponent of staying in the middle of the rubber all the time? Or is it just a Manoah thing?
I think the middle of the rubber is good. Barrios has done it as well, and he's moved to the middle of the rubber too. So I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to give yourself the largest area for mistakes, right?
Sure.
Just like in golf, like you've mentioned, if you're going to tee off on the left side, you've got that big swing and you've got a lot of fairway where you can land the ball. Same with a pitcher. You want to minimize the area of mistakes. And I think that's what you do when you give yourself that better angle. And it's helped Manoah. He's having a phenomenal rookie season. He's among the leaders in a lot of rookie categories. And then Barrios, he really got turned around in his last two starts. And I look for him to be good again tomorrow night.
Hey, Buck, how much interaction would Walker have with the starting pitcher during the game? Because one guy, you know, we always see the shots in the dugouts when a guy's on a roll, nobody's near him. But right. Is that the case for the pitching coach?
Yeah, the pitching coach will come back in, and if he sees anything, and they have checkpoints throughout the course of the game, and Pete goes down, of course, and watches every bullpen session and every side session that pitchers throw. And he'll make suggestions, and he's always standing behind him. And I get to watch this, and he'll recreate the move he wants the guy to make with his hand, the path he wants that breaking ball to travel on, and everything else. And when a pitcher gets out of whack during the game, they have checkpoints. He said, hey, your hand's dropped. Hey, you're a little bit ahead with your shoulder. That's happened a lot to Manoah, and I think that's something to watch with him is if this front shoulder flies, this hand goes this way, and the ball's up and in. As it was against Oakland when he hit Harrison, and he hit Marte on consecutive at bats. So that's his big problem, is getting that ball to the side and having it run up and into right-handed hitters. When he's on top of it, the ball goes down underneath the plane of the bat, and the same to left-handed hitters. When he's down, it runs off the plate, back over the plate, that classic Greg Maddux swing back fastball.
So when you were playing, did you like to sit beside the pitcher that was working at that moment in the dugout, or did you keep a distance? I'm not talking about the no-hitter stuff.
You know. Distance or anything like that. No.
No hitters, you get as far away as possible, right?
No, we would talk all the time, Bob. We would talk before the game, during the game, and after the game. And this was something Charlie and Al gave to me as a player. He was our coach and got a lot of recognition as a hitting coach. I think he was a better pitching coach, because I think he would help pitchers identify weaknesses of opposing hitters. And we had Paul Spitorf and Steve Busby and Dennis Leonard, some real good pitchers in Kansas City. But we would talk during the course of a game. If a guy got a hit, you'd say, well, what happened? How come he hit that pitch? Well, you didn't complete the pitch. You didn't finish the pitch. You left it out over the plate. So now the next time, throw the same pitch, but finish it. And those types of conversations were ongoing all the time.
You know, you talk about momentum. The Jays 6 in a row playing their best baseball. The team they're playing, you know, it has just come off winning 13 in a row and now can't hit the ball out of the infield, it looks like. What do you think's going through the mind of the Yankees right now?
They're in trouble. And especially after the fact that Gerrit Cole walked off the mound with an injury last night, they're in trouble. You know, Gerrit Cole's the only Yankee starter that beat the Blue Jays going back to last year. Nobody else has beat Blue Jays over the span, I believe, since September 21st last year. So we mentioned this at the start of this series. I felt like the Blue Jays had the advantage in the starting pitching matchup in this series, and I still feel that way. And now with Manoah and Berríos finishing up, and this is without Robbie Ray pitching in the four-game series. It's pretty special rotation right now. But I think the Yankees, they're 2-8 in their last 10 after that 13-game win streak, and they're struggling. I mean, you saw what he did last night. Aaron Boone put Andrew Velasquez in at shortstop, and Gleyber Torres is supposed to be the big slugging shortstop. No Gary Sanchez in the game because Gerrit Cole pitched and Higashioka catches him. So the big bat was out of the lineup. Two big bats, actually, with Sanchez and Gleyber Torres. But Boone knows that they're in trouble right now. I think they're very, very pitchable. You can pitch to them. You make good pitches, you're going to get them out. Aaron Judge hit four routine fly balls last night. Stanton had a line drive base hit that should have been caught. So I think the Blue Jays are doing a nice job of neutralizing these Yankee bats.
There's so many funny things about this game that make it different from any other sport. Mostly because I guess you play every day and you're playing 162 as opposed to 16 or 82 or whatever. But I don't know if you remember this, Buck. In the early 80s, the Minnesota Twins, I want to say, lost 13 in a row and then broke the streak and won 12 in a row. Like, those kinds of things don't happen often, but they happen with some kind of regularity in this game, much like the Yankees streak. You know, they rattle off, 13 in a row and now are having trouble winning, like right off the back of that. Is there an explanation for it?
No. I think it was pretty interesting when they won the first two games in Oakland on the road trip. And at the end of the game, the 13th, when Michael Kay, their TV announcer, said, the Yankees can't get beaten right now. The Yankees are never going to lose. And all of a sudden, they're 2-8 in their last 10 games. And you know, he was right. When you see the Yankees winning 13 games in a row, you feel like they're invincible. But that's baseball. That's the beauty of baseball. Every single day brings you a new set of challenges, no matter how good you are or how bad you are. And Baltimore is a great example. They just took out 2 out of 3 against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium.
Well, and they lost 19 in a row, right?
Yeah.
And have played pretty good baseball since then.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of baseball. I think There are several things that make it so interesting. Last night, Gerrit Cole buzzed the tower of Vladdy in the first at bat. And Vladdy was going, oh, okay, that's the way we're going to play it now. And sure enough, he took him out of his game. He snapped the hitting streak. But there's so many things that go on inside the game on a nightly basis that a lot of people might not recognize. But Vladdy got a little bit over anxious after that because he really wanted to hit against Cole. He got a hanging breaking ball after that fastball up and in and popped it up. And then he had a big swing couple times later, just not swinging the way he did during the hot streak. So it kind of took him out of his game. And another thing that was really interesting that happened last night, and Pat pointed this out on the broadcast, Steven Matz was dealing. I mean, he was just sailing along. And then Brett Gardner moseyed up to the plate, stepped out of the box two or three times, and just took the momentum right out of the sails of Steven Matz during that at bat. Gardner got on base, got another base hit, and all of a sudden it looked like Matz was out of sorts. To his credit, Steven got it back very quickly. But Brett Gardner, he had a plan when he went up in that particular bat. I think it was his second at bat of the game.
The advantages of being 38 years old with, 15 years in the big leagues, right? You know all those exactly. tricks, right?
You know, the other thing is when you were, if you were the manager and doing the lineup card in April, May, and maybe even June, if Springer was healthy, I don't think Alejandro Kirk would be your DH. But when you can get Kirk as your DH to contribute the way he did again last night, two more home runs, that's something special that this team is doing right now. And it really does display their depth, doesn't it?
Well, it sure does, John. And you know what? I was a guy that was always skeptical about Alejandro Kirk. I thought, you know what? Everybody's so excited about this guy swinging the bat. And there's such a small sample of what he has done going back to last year as well. But he can hit. He can really hit. He reminds me, remember Jose Morales of the Minnesota Twins, a big right-handed hitter. And he could flat out hit too. He had no position. He couldn't play anywhere. But his bat stays in the zone so long, and he has such a level swing. That ball he hit out the right field, you know, both of them were up and out over the plate, but he's on top of the ball, and he's able to drive it the other way. He can hit. And obviously the concern is his physical conditioning, you know, how long can he stand up physically carrying around that much weight? So, you know, but I got to give it to him. He's done a nice job behind the plate as well. You remember early on, he was catching on one knee.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I know you talked about it on the broadcast because you don't like it, do you?
Oh, I hate it. I don't understand how you can value framing five pitches a game over giving up two or three wild pitches or fast balls in the game. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't translate. If you're going to credit a catcher for stealing five strikes during a 200-pitch game, that's not as important as giving up 90 feet two or three different times in a close game.
One thing I wanted to mention that you brought up, because you mentioned Charlie Lau's name earlier, and Charlie was legendary in the baseball world for his somewhat unique teaching methods. You would know it better than anybody. But we talked about Kirk. We've talked many times, and you have as well, about Kirk and how he is able to keep his bat on the same plane for an extended period of time rather than have an uppercut swing or a swing that goes down. That was Charlie used to preach that, did he not?
Yes, that was all about the level swing. And you know, Ted Williams and Joe Gordon were two of the best hitters in the history of the game. And I was a 20-year-old rookie in 1969 in Washington at RFK Stadium. Williams was managing the Senators, Gordon was managing our Royals, and they were arguing the merits of swinging up and swinging down. And Williams was a swing up guy. He said, the ball's coming down, you want to meet it on a plane going up. And obviously that's true. Joe Gordon was a down guy who wanted to impart backspin on it so he'd get a lot of carry. And Joe wasn't a big guy, but he's one of the second basemen and hit a lot of home runs. When you talk about Marcus Semien, and Joe is in the Hall of Fame, of course, as Ted Williams. But Charlie Lau's theory was get back. You remember George Brett's stance. It was all way back on the back leg. And then he finished through and had a long extended swing. And by that, the plane of the bat, the barrel of the bat stayed in the zone a longer time. If you swing down or up, it's in and out of the zone in a very short span of time. So your chance of hitting baseball is a matter of inches, 3 or 4 inches. Now you're trying to hit a round baseball with a bat that's 2 3/4 inches wide, trying to hit it. And you're really creating a problem for yourself. But what Kirk does is he stays level all the way through, much like Dustin Pedroia. Pedroia was very good at this as well, where he would have the extension and not only try to hit it out in front of the plate, but beyond, another foot and a half farther out where he'd get good extension and carry.
You know, one of those that we're just yakking here, but I'm always puzzled by when I see a hitter come up, and you know, you see it less now than you used to, and his hands are way up high, I don't know how you swing from there. And yeah, sure, they drop them down instinctively in advance. But I had a hitting coach who was kind of a Charlie Lau disciple, even though he didn't know who Charlie Lau was. And he used to tell me, keep your hands a little lower, and that'll make it easier to keep the bat on the same plane and throughout the swing. And I think didn't Charlie preach that too? Don't get your hands too high.
It's interesting because, you know, Charlie's ideal setup for a batting stance, and he did this time and time again, and he did this with Brett. He would put the bat across home plate, lay it on the ground, and then he would tell George, put your hands on your knees and bend over to waist. So he would put his hands on his knees, bend over to waist. He said, now pick up the bat and place it on your shoulder. And that was it. That was the batting stance. And that's how simple it was. So in 1973, they played the All-Star game at Royal Stadium in Kansas City. At the time, it was Royal Stadium.
Yeah.
And Charlie Lau hired a cameraman that had a high-speed 16-millimeter camera. And he would go back and forth from the dugouts to record left-handed hitters and right-handed hitters. And I believe there were 7 home runs hit in that game. And it was Bobby Tolan, Yaz, Bench, you know, a lot of different hitting styles. And at the end of the evaluation of that video, every one of those guys, no matter where they started the bat, I think Bobby Bonds was in there too, and he started around his belt buckle. No matter where they started, when that front foot hit the ground, their bat was over their shoulder in the same spot. Every single one of the home runs. Hmm. When that front foot hit the ground, no matter where they started, their bat was here and it was going back. And Charlie always used to talk about a boxer. He said, if you're fighting, do you want to hit somebody from here or from here? And just look at that move. I mean, that's a natural move. I'm going to load back here and then go forward. I'm not going to be here and try to punch like that because there's no force behind it.
Interesting. We got a lot more to talk about. We'll come back with Buck Martinez after these messages. It's McCallum and Shannon. It's Buck Martinez. All right.
I love the Charlie Lau stuff. I really do. that he was, you know, in the 70s as a kid watching baseball, the Royals were a fascinating team to watch all the time. You know, even when they became an expansion team and guys like Lou Piniella were on the team.
Yep.
But because they could hit the Buck Martinez, yeah. Because they could hit the ball so well. It was so much fun to watch them. You guys could hit the ball around the ballpark almost any time.
Well, and you know what, John? We were perfectly suited to play in Royal Stadium.
A big stadium, right?
It was turf. It was a big ballpark. I think Amos Otis led the team with 26 home runs. Nobody hit any home runs. You played third base, first base, you played everywhere. You spread out the defense as much as possible, and we could run. Line drives and triples and doubles, and that was the name of the game. And Hal McCray was the guy that kind of brought that big red machine mentality to Kansas City and passed it on to all of us.
Yeah, that's a really, to me, that club, I don't know why I do remember that club. I guess you were better than most expansion teams. You guys actually made a big difference. I want to get back to tonight with Manoah on the mound for the Jays.
Can I do one thing, John? Can I interrupt you? I don't like to do that. I want you to keep
you, that you spot. Love interrupting me, Bob, but go ahead.
Well, I went and got something because I knew I had it here. This is a movie poster. And I don't know if you guys can see this or not. But yeah. I have this, and I want to know if you remember this movie. It was a movie called Max Dugan Returns.
I remember the name.
And Matthew Broderick was in it. He was a little kid. And do you know who his coach was? His baseball coach in that movie? Charlie Lau.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie actually played that role in the movie.
Yeah.
Little tidbit of nothing. Just for fun.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to Manoah tonight. So sure. For the second consecutive night, the Jays have a pitcher who basically is a New Yorker going into New York. Because Max is a Long Island kid too. And Manoah, his family now lives in New York, I believe. What's that like? When you used to go back to San Francisco or used to go play in Oakland, what was that like to go home, and how much difference does that make?
Well, first of all, let me say Manoa's family's from Miami. They were all in New York for his debut. That's where you're thinking. Okay. I mean, because there was a big contingent of Manoa fans.
I just assumed that they were from Queens.
Yeah. But when you go back home, it's always kind of special because I grew up watching the Giants in San Francisco. And then when I would go to Oakland to play the A's, of course, a lot of family and friends would come down. And that was always fun. And, you know, you felt like you wanted to do something special because when you were there, playing as a kid, you were a special player, obviously, to get signed and go on and play college and eventually pro. But Mats, I think, gets energized when he goes back to the city. Of course, pitching for the Mets for all those years and being a Long Island guy, he had two of his best starts this year at Yankee Stadium. But for Manoa, I think the fact that he pitched so well in his debut on the 27th of May, won that game, beat the Yankees. And you know, going back to spring training, he had that great outing against the Yankees in spring training in a night game over at Steinbrenner Field when he struck out seven straight Yankees. Now, mind you, it was spring training and everybody kind of discounted it, but I think it had an impact on him because he knew at that time that he could pitch against big league hitters. Now, he has made a lot of improvements since he first came up, which we've talked about, moving on the rubber and all these changes. But Alek Manoa at 6'6", 265, is a pitcher.
Yeah.
He's not a power guy. He's a pitcher. He understands how to manipulate the baseball. And if you watch him throw his slider, he will throw that slider with different breaks, different angles, and different speeds. He has a good feel for pitching.
All right, so here's a question that's premature and effectively inappropriate. But Blue Jays get to a wild card game, and you can manipulate your rotation in such a way to get to a wild card game, which you can't do in very many situations. But who's your pitcher in the wild card game, and then what's your rotation in the first round of postseason?
Robbie Ray's pitcher in the wild card game without hesitation.
Pretty obvious, I think. Yeah,
Alek Manoa pitches game one of the division series. Barrios pitches game two. Ryu pitches game three, and Ray pitches game four.
And so Mats becomes your long guy, right?
Yep.
And if anybody gets in trouble early, he's the guy you go to.
Yep. It depends, too, on who you're playing, obviously, but there's no question about it. If the Blue Jays play in a wild card game, Robbie Ray is my pitcher, and I make sure that he's the pitcher available. If you don't have to win a game the last series and Robbie Ray's lined up to pitch in that series, I don't pitch it. If you're in the wild card game, whether it's first or second position, Robbie Ray, he's my pitcher.
Well, I think about it a fair bit. Well, I have been the last week or so as things have looked brighter for the Blue Jays.
But you weren't thinking about it 2 weeks ago.
Neither were you. Let's be honest. None of us were. But Springer's going to come back. He's a guy who has pitched out of the bullpen. So he...
Stripling.
Why did I say Springer? Stripling, sorry. He has pitched out of the bullpen. He knows what that's like. At this point, he's, you know, barring an injury, he's not going to be in the rotation. He's not going to get a start probably in the regular season and certainly not in the postseason. So now you've got two guys. You got Stripling and you've got Mats to come out as potential long guys, or at least guys that could throw a couple of innings here and there. Suddenly the bullpen, doesn't it look a lot stronger for the postseason? Just that little bit of, you know, adding two guys that have been in the rotation to the pen, at least in theory.
Yeah. I'll take it a step further. How about Julian Merriweather and Nate Pearson?
Bingo.
Yeah. If those two guys can have a handful of outings and throw strikes, first and foremost, they got to throw strikes. Yeah. Pearson was better in his second outing than he was his first outing as far as throwing strikes. And when he throws strikes, he's dominant. And Merriweather, we saw what he's capable of doing in the first series against the Yankees back in April. He picked up two saves in the series, but he's been hurt. Now, if he can get into several games five or six games before the postseason and has that same kind of success, all of a sudden your bullpen looks a lot different. With Mazes, with Mazes, Simber, Romano, Merriweather, Pearson, Stripling, and Matz, that's pretty formidable.
Well, and so here's a question as the former manager. Do you stretch out your starters in postseason? Do you give them, if the bar now is 90 to 100 pitches, do you give them 100 to 110 or 110 to 120?
Robbie Ray has open canvas. He can pitch as long as he's effective. He's phenomenal at keeping himself in great shape. His velocity is the same from the first pitch to the last pitch. Alek Manoah is the same way. I pitch him as long as he's effective. Ryu, I don't. If I get six effective innings out of Ryu, he's out of the game.
Why? Why the difference?
Just because I think that he's more prone to making a mistake later on. You saw him pitch the last time. He threw a lot of sliders against the Yankees on Monday. Came out with a little forearm tightness. Nothing that's going to keep him from pitching. But I just think that I would feel more comfortable stretching out Robbie Ray and Alek Manoah than I would Ryu. And I think, too, because here's another reason. If Ryu throws six innings in his fashion, changeups, cutters, fastballs, now you go to Merriweather or Pearson or somebody that throws close to 100, you've changed the whole dynamic for the opposing team. They're thinking changeup, cutter, breaking ball. And now you've got to deal with 100-mile-an-hour fastball. I think that's why I would be quick to get Ryu out of the game as opposed to Robbie Ray.
How would you treat Barrios? You didn't mention him.
Barrios would be in the mix, too. I think Barrios, like I said, I think he would start game three in a division series if Robbie Ray pitched game one of a wild card. It would be, for me, it would be, how did I have it set up? Robbie Ray pitches, Manoah opens up, Barrios comes second.
Right.
Division,
right.
And then
the third.
And then Ryu.
Yeah. You got to get this team to that point, though. 25 games.
Well, sure.
25 games.
Charlie's done a terrific job all season long. And people say, well, what about that Yankee series coming up? He said, I'm not concerned about the Yankee series coming up. I'm concerned about the Baltimore Orioles tonight. And that's the way the team plays. You know, they're not looking ahead to anything. And a great example of that was that comeback against the A's. You know, they didn't see that they were beat. They didn't think that they were done. And they just kept plugging away. And the beauty of this team is we have talked about the top five guys in the order almost all year long. But now all of a sudden with Gurriel down at the bottom and Kirk and Jansen and McGuire doing their thing and Richard getting a few hits here and there, I think the bottom of the order has set up the top of the order very effectively of late. This team, I think they've hit a home run in 10 straight games now. And it's not the same guy. I know Semien is on a run. He's got six home runs in his last six games. But there's a lot of people capable of winning games by themselves in this lineup.
You know, and it's interesting and worth pointing out, I think, too, that when they were struggling offensively, it was all about not cashing in runners in scoring position.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't that they weren't hitting. It wasn't that they weren't getting on base. They weren't quite as prolific, but they had an incredible streak of I don't know, 0 for 23 bucks, something like
that. Yeah. And, you know, that's youth and inexperience.
Yeah.
That's what happens. When you look at the teams that perform well with runners in scoring position, they're older. They're more experienced. They know what the situation's like. They can handle it. Well, these kids going through it for the first time in a pennant race have a tendency to think, I got to get this done. If I don't get this done, we're not going to win. And that you can't do that to yourself. So last night was a great example. The Blue Jays had two sacrifice flies and then one inning.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese McGuire had his first ever sacrifice fly. Gurriel had the other one. So that's the type of things you have to do to win in the postseason. Tough at bats, sac fly, get that guy in from third, and you're going to advance in the postseason.
And that's compounded because a lot of these young guys have never played 162 game season as well. And that's part of this learning curve.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's not about them being tired physically. I mean, Bob, you, John, and I, when we're 22, we didn't get tired. We didn't need any sleep, and you never got tired. And that's just the way it is with youth. But mentally, you start thinking about, man, this is game 148 and I'm 0-for-12 and I got to do something different. No, you have to get back to doing the same thing consistently. And that's what Vladdy has done.
Hey, I want to change it. I want to change the topic. Sorry, Bob. Today's a special day, September 8th. You know, the Cooperstown, the Hall of Fame. Larry Walker's going in finally, officially. Derek Jeter. But the guy I want to talk about is somebody you touched on the broadcast last night, and that's Marvin Miller, who I think there are generations of people now that don't understand the impact this one person had on not just baseball, but on all sports. And you had a close interaction with this guy. What was he like?
Well, John, he was a labor negotiator, first and foremost. He had worked for the National Labor Relations Board. He had worked for United Steelworkers in Pittsburgh. He had negotiated major contracts for unions in the past. And baseball had a union, but it was ineffective. And Marvin had a lot of resistance when he came in. From players, because players that were in good spots, players that had played for the same team for a while, the owner was telling them, hey, you guys don't need a union. I'll take care of you. Here's a little extra money. And the veteran players were the ones that were pushing back against Marvin Miller. But there were enough core players that understood that, first of all, they're undervalued. Players weren't receiving the salaries they were deserving. The pension fund was unfunded. And that was a main concern. And that when Marvin first came in, Jim Bunning, Robin Roberts, and Harvey Keene were the guys that recruited him and interviewed him. And they kept saying, we want you to get our pension straight. And Marvin kept thinking, there are a lot bigger issues than pension for you guys. There's health and safety. There's salary. There's service time. There's manipulation of up and down movement to the minor leagues. And he just laid it out all for them. The biggest value, the biggest asset that Marvin had was he was a listener, and he listened to the concerns of the players. When he eventually did get hired, he would go around to all of the clubs, and the clubs would force him to have his meetings out on the baseball field. They didn't allow him to come in the clubhouse because he was their union guy, and they didn't want any union guys in. And the salaries were reduced, and they were held down because there was no free agency. My first year in the major leagues, I made $10,000 in 1969. My sixth year on a championship team in Kansas City, I made $16,000. My wife was making more money flying for American Airlines than I was playing for the Kansas City Royals. But free agency came in. Marvin understood that there was a lot of money being made in baseball and the players weren't getting their fair share. So he introduced free agency, arbitration, all of these things raised the level of the game for everyone, including the owners, because now players were more valuable. There was a bigger interest in baseball. Fans came to the ballpark and everybody prospered from what Marvin Miller did. But they always say, well, Marvin is the guy and the players are just following what Marvin said. That's not true one at all. Marvin Miller laid out all of the options to the players and the players made the decisions. But he was so good at explaining the ramifications of our decisions and what we were deserving that everybody understood perfectly. In 1985, I broke my leg and went to New York to negotiate. And Marvin was in the background then. He was a consultant. Donald Fear was the executive director of the Players Association. And we were at Lee McPhail's house until about 4 a.m, finally agreed to a deal. And we walked out of that meeting, and I was on crutches, and we're walking up the streets of Manhattan going to breakfast. And I asked Marvin, I says, Marvin, what concerns you about this settlement? He said, it concerns me that the owners tried and finally figured out how to divide the union. You do it on two issues, the arbitration, which is an issue for the young players, and the pension, which is an issue for the older players. And that was the dividing factor, and that's why it took so long to get all the players together. But Marvin was a genius and a quality man. We all looked up to him like he was our favorite uncle, and he had great advice for us all the time. And he did a hell of a job of bringing the union together.
That Marvin Miller is going into the Baseball Hall of Fame is as deserving as anyone, any player, any manager. The shame is that it happened 20 years at least too late.
Yeah. Well, and he actually predicted, if I'm not mistaken, he actually predicted, oh, I might get to the Hall of Fame, but I'll have to.
Long after he's gone. Yeah. And that's why his family, I don't think his family is showing up today. I believe Don Fehr is making the speech. I think Gene Orza is presenting Don Fehr, and Don Fehr will speak on Marvin's family's behalf. So yeah, it's really sad because
it really is
so good. And he was concerned about the game, and the game, the pendulum had swung to the owner's side for so many years. And then he was the one that he advised Curt Flood. He's the one that told Curt Flood, if you do this decision and decide not to play, you won't play again. And Curt was strong enough of a man to know that his rights were not being upheld, and he didn't play. And they traded him from St. Louis to Philadelphia, which was a last place team. And he said, I'm not going. And then Andy Messerschmidt and Dave McNally both played without a contract. And Marvin was advising them as well and said, you're going to test it and it's going to be a challenge. But if you're willing to do it, you're going to have an impact in the game forever. And they certainly have.
That was like 1973, 74, somewhere around
I think it was 74, 75, because okay. Free agency came in 76.
You know, it's kind of scary because I remember it just like it was yesterday. It was a big, big thing. We, you know, the fans today who are younger, who see players in all sports.
Bob, the players, I hate to say it, but the players today.
Yeah.
I was just asked to host a panel for Marvin Miller, and it was myself, Alan Berra, who wrote Marvin's book titled A Whole Different Ball Game. Mm-hmm. Steve Rogers, whom you both know from Montreal, and he's with the Players Association, and Dave Winfield. And we talked to the Players Association employees to let them know what Marvin was all about. And they put together a video that they're going to show at various places about the history.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, it was really good. And we had it for about an hour. I think they pared it down to 16, 18 minutes. But it talks about the important aspects of why Marvin was so important, who was involved in making the decision, how much resistance there was by the players initially, and finally, what a benefit it was to have him.
But the influence that Marvin Miller and what you people did in baseball, because you were the leaders of this. I mean, the other sports looked to Major League Baseball for guidance, Major League Baseball Players Association for guidance. The NFL is a different world because of that. The NHL and the NBA are different worlds because of what you guys did and what Marvin Miller did in the 70s for the Major League Baseball Players Association.
No question. And I remember specifically talking to NFL players. They would call up and say, how come Tom Condon is one guy that I talked to. We were both in Kansas City, played for the Chiefs forever. And Bob Avellini, another quarterback with the Bears, they would say, how come your guys' pension is so good? I said, because we stick together. And that's what football does to you guys. They separate you because they're telling you that you're not as good as this guy and this guy's not as good as you, and they separate you, but you have to be unified. It's interesting, too, that during the negotiations in 85, I sat in the office and I was answering the phones a lot, talking to players. But Howard Cosell would come and sit with us almost every night. And he would talk about the game and the status of the game. And he really believed what players were doing was right. But I got one very interesting phone call one afternoon when I picked up the phone and I said, Players Association. And a very gruff voice said, is Marvin Miller there? And I said, no, he's not. Can I ask who's calling? This is Charlie Finley. I said, really? And Finley, of course, was out of the game by now. But he said, you just tell Marvin Miller. He said, first of all, who's this? I said, Buck Martinez. He goes, oh, Buck, I want you to give Marvin a message. He said, you tell Marvin Miller to stick by your guns. You guys are doing the right thing.
Wow. Yeah, this is after he's out of the game. What would he have said when he was...
And this is after he tried to sell Catfish Hunter. This is after he tried to sell Catfish Hunter to the Yankees, right?
No, it was Joe Rudy and Vida Blue. Catfish Hunter had a flaw in his contract. Charlie didn't reach some of the payments in his contract, so he became a free agent for the time with the Yankees. He tried to sell Joe Rudy and Vida Blue and Raleigh Fingers. And there's a picture, I believe, of... I think it's Rudy in blue to Boston in Boston uniform. And the commissioner said no, because you can't sell players. Compensation, right?
Right.
And what do you have now for free agents? Compensation, Charlie Finley's rule. And they wouldn't let Finley do it in the 70s, but now they're doing it in 2021.
Three guys of a certain age reminiscing about all kinds of stuff from a long time ago. We may have put a lot of people to sleep, but boy, I had a lot of fun today. Thanks, Bucko. It's always
hey, you know what? You know, Buck, we're going to give you the jacket today, Buck. We're going to give you the jacket.
You get the jacket.
I never would have got the jacket as a player.
I didn't say that.
Play in Seattle, you would have got the jacket as you were, you know, wheeled off on the stretcher. So.
Well, I would have been a good one too.
Yeah.
Thanks, pal. We'll see you soon.
Always good to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Buck Martinez, we'll come back after this. Well, needless to say, we thank Buck Martinez for joining us. I always enjoy the conversations, but I don't know, maybe it's we're of a certain age, but when we're able to look back into the past and recall some of the really interesting and revolutionary things that happened in sport, you know, we don't spend enough time thinking about it. What?
The thing about Buck is even his explanation of certain little things about pitchers, you know, foot position on the mound, you know, he doesn't get enough credit as a solid analyst.
And the intriguing thing, you will know this because of your history in broadcasting, but here's a guy who one day is in the one chair and one day is in the two chair. A lot of people that can do that.
No. Well, and there, let's face it. I mean, baseball is one sport where it's happened a bit more, but former players being the play-by-play man. The list is not very long, Bob.
No, it is not.
Buck's done an outstanding job. And the Marvin Miller stuff to me is, you know, that was of a time when at your age and at my age, that was news. That was important. There was as many stories in the newspaper about what was going on with the players' union as there was the games. You wondered if baseball would ever be the same. The threats that the owner said they're going to ruin baseball. We're never going to be able to identify a player with a team. Well, all it did was make baseball bigger. That's all it did.
Well, I'm really not showing off when I'm, or at least attempting to, but I actually interviewed Marvin Miller several times on radio, 2, 3, 4 times. And I can tell you, after the first interview, I was intimidated every time afterwards.
Yeah.
He was such a smart and eloquent speaker. You couldn't put anything over Marvin Miller. And it's a shame. It's wonderful that he gets to go into the Baseball Hall of Fame, but it should have been 30 years ago.
Well, it should have been when he was alive, at least.
Well, yeah, I said 20 years earlier, maybe 40 years ago. I don't know.
That was not going to happen, Bob. That was not going to happen.
I know that, and you know that.
Yeah.
But hopefully Marvin is looking down and will enjoy the day. Yeah. We must off. Another show for you tomorrow. We think
I'll do this tomorrow.
Oh, you're now giving away who we have on.
I'm confident Mr. Dubas is showing up. So
well,
yes.
I asked you to if you wanted to give away the last couple of guests, and you were reluctant to do that. So I didn't want to
I'm
say
not reluctant today.
Kyle Dubas, the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, tomorrow. Hope you'll join us for that. Until then, for John Shannon McCowan, see ya.